Well, hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast.
I wanted to let you know that this summer, I will be teaching a two-week workshop with JSS in Civita from June 24th to July 8th, 2019. So join me in Civita Castellana, where we will paint the Italian countryside and idyllic village just north of Rome. This is a two-week landscape painting workshop in Italy, where we will focus on fundamental painting skills and personal critiques. The best way to improve your painting skills is to get out there and paint more. So you will get plenty of painting time along with direct feedback in our critiques. I won't sugarcoat that feedback, but at the same time, I know what it's like to try your best and still not quite get what you were looking for. So you'll learn how to deal with that if or when it happens. After 2 weeks of painting with me, you'll leave with a better understanding of color, how color reacts to its surrounding hues, and how to mix the right one for your canvas. You'll learn the right questions to ask yourself so that you can accurately depict the colors of the Italian landscape, including those infinite greens. As you wander through the cobblestone streets of Civita and look out over the countryside, you'll notice a distinctive quality to the light. We'll talk about how to capture that light and depict the effects of atmospheric perspective onto your canvas. How you arrange an image, the shapes that you choose to emphasize, what you decide to include or remove, these are the decisions that strengthen or weaken a painting. These choices are also what make your work uniquely yours. So when artists ask, "How do I find my voice?" it starts here, and we're going to talk a lot about that in our time together. JSS in Civita is a program like none other. You get to experience the birthplace of landscape painting, meet lots of artists who share your passion for painting, have access to weekly excursions to see important works of art, and weekly JSS-sponsored communal dinners. It is so much fun. So if you want to find out about this unique experience, go to savvypainter.com/workshops. And I hope to paint with you in Italy.
My guest this week on the Savvy Painter Podcast is Suzanne Unrein. Suzanne is originally from California and now lives and paints in New York. Her paintings and works on paper explore a vibrant world of humans and animals. Her work is characterized by vibrant colors and expressive gestures. She takes the heightened emotions of the Baroque and Rococo movements and makes them her own. In this episode, Suzanne and I talk about intuition and how dreams influence her paintings every now and again, as well as some differences on how we start a painting. We've all seen artists start in a super controlled manner, with lots of preparation beforehand, which allows them to have many of the obvious problems solved already. Then there's the more intuitive painters, who jump right in. That might be me. They attack the canvas, as it were, and figure it out as they go along. There's pros and cons to both methods, and probably 1,000 variations of ways to start a painting in between. We talk about the warnings artists like Picasso left us in their early work, the gift of not knowing, Suzanne's biggest takeaway from a recent art residency, and of course, we talk about her process and what happens in her studio. So without further ado, here is Suzanne Unrein. Suzanne, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter Podcast. I'm excited to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Tell us a little bit about when you started out as an artist. Do you remember making a decision to dedicate yourself to art?
You know, it's funny. I grew up in a very middle-class background in Central Florida, and there was no actual artists that I knew of that I didn't know you could be an artist and make a living as an artist. There was like arts and crafts fairs and things like that, but there was nobody actually creating something they wanted to create and selling it and making a living from that. So when I went to college, I wanted to study commercial art because I figured I could do drawing, and which I loved to do and had always done. But I didn't really know anything about being an actual artist until I started taking art history classes from studying commercial art. There was a lot of art history that you had to take and a lot of drawing classes and painting classes, which I loved. But within those art history classes were when I really started seeing the first real art I had ever seen in my life, other than when I played Masterpiece as a kid. I don't know if you remember that board game, Masterpiece.
Do
you remember?
Yes. Wow. I forgot all about that.
My mom had that Masterpiece game, and that was the first time I actually saw paintings like Hopper and abstract paintings like Franz Klein, I think, was in there, and Pollock. And so I was super excited about art from seeing Masterpiece and then again from my art history classes. And then after I got out of school and realized I had no desire to do commercial art, I had read this article in a magazine, and it was on artists that were living in Los Angeles. And I was living in Florida at the time. And it was the whole article, and I can't remember who was on, but I think it was probably like Ed Ruscha, John Baldessari. I think those were the people who were sort of doing art back then. And the whole thing was on how LA artists were doing things that were very unique and sort of outside the art world a bit from New York. And I think I just love that idea of they're doing things that are really unique and outside the art world. And I felt comfortable with that idea. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to move to LA and see what that's all about. So it was really in moving to Los Angeles and making that conscious decision then to become an artist from reading that article and wanting to move somewhere where people were creating art. And I wanted to see what that was all about. That was really, I think, the deciding factor. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, I got a job. And then when I wasn't working, I was trying to paint, trying to learn how to paint.
Did you know anybody in LA, or you just picked up and moved out?
I knew one guy who was the brother of a girl I knew from college, and he lived out there. And I had met him at a wedding, at her wedding, actually, the summer before. And he said, oh, if you ever want to move to LA, you know, you got a place to stay.
Be careful what you offer.
Exactly. Poor guy. So another friend of mine, this was the summer after we graduated, and I wanted to move somewhere. And I had read that article. I thought, what about LA? And I was talking to her, and she said, oh, I just was in LA. I'd love to move to LA. So we just packed our bags and packed our cars, and we moved.
I love it. That is funny. That's something I would do.
It was just random. It's so not thought out, you know.
So what happened when you got there?
Well, it took me a while. I mean, I was painting in our living room and I was waitressing. I went to museums. I had never lived anywhere where there were these great museums with amazing art. And I was looking at what was showing there. I was really excited about any of the old masters. I love the Baroque and the Rococo and the Abstract Expressionists. And I think one of the first shows that was there when I moved was a German Expressionist show that was at LACMA, which was Los Angeles County Museum of Art there. And I fell in love with George Grosz and Otto Dix and Oskar Kokoschka and all those German Expressionist painters. And so those were the ones that inspired me for those first terrible paintings I was doing in Los Angeles.
Do you remember the name of that exhibition? I have a book on German Expressionism, and I can't for right now as you're talking, I'm thinking, what is the title of that book?
I think it might have been The Degenerate Art Show.
That's it.
Yeah. That was the show. And it was amazing. I mean, to have gone from not seeing anything, you know, I mean, actually one spring break when I was in college, my parents had moved for a year to DC or outside of DC. And my mom said, hey, if you come up here for spring break, I'll take you to New York so you can see paintings. Cause she knew I really wanted to see some real paintings and not just in my art history class with slides, you know? And so that was my first time. And then my second time was moving to LA and going to these museums. So for that Degenerate Art Show to be one of the first shows, and it was one of my favorite sort of movements. It was phenomenal.
That seems like a sign from the universe or something.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. That's amazing. Because that was an amazing show. I mean, intense.
Yeah, amazing show. And then also they had the Contemporary Temporary back then, which I don't know if that even exists anymore. I think it's the Geffen Contemporary now. They had great, big, huge shows of contemporary art there too, which I was fascinated by.
Wow. I've seen your work described as Baroque or Rococo. How do you feel like that's an accurate description of your work?
I think my work is inspired by that time period for sure, but I wouldn't describe it probably as that. I could describe it sort of as gestural. expressionism or something. I think what I take from the Rococo and Baroque that I love is their heightened emotions. And there's a lot of amazing movement in their paintings. And that's what excites me, that I take from that I like to hopefully have in my own painting.
Yeah, it definitely comes across, that gestural movement in the paintings / drawings. Like, your paintings are almost drawings with a paintbrush. And that's what I love, is being able to see the line in there. It's just so juicy. So for somebody who hasn't seen your work, I'm trying to like think of how I would describe it in an audio podcast. And it is very gestural. I'm going to be quiet right now and let you describe it. I was about to go into this description of your work, but I feel like you should do that. Can I torture you with that?
That is such torture. Can I read from my artist statement? I'm actually going to read it from my artist statement and see if it sounds terrible.
Let's hear it.
My work is constantly evolving. However, what I'm doing now, I think, is I'm creating work that has as much to do with the act of painting as it does about our relationship to nature and our relationship to our animal selves. I think that we take ourselves out of the animal kingdom so often and think we're sort of above it or not even animals anymore. And so for me, I think it's about thinking about us as animals and putting it into perspective with the rest of the animals and depicting sort of what that means in terms of being present and having a connection or not having a connection. So I think the worlds that I create are ones that involve that, whether it's about us with our own animal selves or it's about us with the rest of the natural world.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit more, about what that feeling of how you're playing with that in your work, like the separation between the human and the animal? Because it's such an interesting topic that we're so...
I feel like we're so far removed, and maybe because I'm also living in New York City, where there's, you know, aside from some pigeons and some, you know, seagulls. And actually, I'm a runner and I like to run by the river. So I see a lot of birds. And actually, it's just a great way for me to get into nature when I'm mostly in a concrete jungle. But, you know, I think not only that, but just we're becoming more of a technological society. And I just feel like it's like we're further and further removing ourselves from nature. So for me, I want to have these paintings that sort of live within nature. And often I think because we don't, I think a lot of my colors become more heightened and more heightened, which I think is not only about what's happening within the scene, but also it's probably like there's an artifice to it that has to do with the fact that we're not really living within the worlds that I'm creating.
Interesting. Yeah, because your colors are so... they're vibrant, but they're
not really natural, you know?
No, they're not natural, but they completely work. Like, they're so intriguing. And even, like, I'm just curious how... is this too weird of a question if I just ask you, like, what are you thinking when you're planning out this composition? Or is it completely instinctual?
It's pretty instinctual. I think I usually come up with... I usually see part of it, envision part of it, and then the rest of it sort of comes together. For instance, I recently did a painting that it actually had to do with something that had happened to me 10 years earlier, which was I had gone through a breakup with somebody and I had gone back to stay with my parents for a bit. It was my ex-husband. And I would be talking on the phone to this one friend of mine. And every time I talked to him, it seemed there was this alligator that would come pacing back and forth, you know.
Being from Los Angeles and yes. From California, like for some reason, a bear walking, you know, because I've lived in the mountains, a bear walking outside doesn't faze me, but an alligator.
Yeah. So this alligator would just be, you know, swimming around. And it always seemed to happen when I was on the phone with this friend of mine. And so we would talk about it and woman sort of fighting or having this relationship in some way with this alligator. And that became the basis of the painting, which was started out as a drawing. So I usually do start out as drawing. So I sort of drew that image. And then I just sort of saw, oh, there's an owl. And then there's this sort of lush Florida terrain and there's a river and, you know, and so then I start seeing these other images. And then you know, oh, there's a blue here. Oh, I see this color. So in that way, it's intuitive. But the first part tends to be like a little part of the painting that I see, and then it builds upon itself. If I listen to the painting, if I'm good at listening to the painting, it will.
Yeah, which is very difficult.
I know we want to control everything, don't we?
We do. I think a lot of us, including myself, often want, I'm backing out of that just a little bit now. I feel like I've got that piece under control, but this, for now, let's say, I don't want to jinx myself, but I think just as human beings, we have this desire to, like, it's almost like we want a crystal ball before we make a decision in our painting or in life. We want to know for sure that that's going to turn out. Like, there's, like, we have this idea somehow that there's a way to, quote unquote, do it right, or know that this will all be okay, whether it's a painting or a decision to.
Yeah. I always wonder if, you know, because I have some artist friends who, like me, are, you know, do a very intuitive painting that will work or not work, you know, every day it could get destroyed. And then I have other painter friends who are very much more, have much more controlled canvases where they know from the start exactly how it's going to turn out because it's more realistically painted or whatever. And I always wonder if those of us who choose this other route are like trying to learn life lessons along the way, you know?
What do you think about that?
I think probably, or at least I hope that we're learning something by struggling with this day in and day out and sort of surrender to, you know, a lot of what is out there just to be gleaned from, you know, as opposed to trying.
Okay. You just cut right when you were, as opposed to just trying.
Ah,
I know.
As opposed to just. That's a perfect example, right? We're like annoyed about this technological thing, but yet it's life, right?
Yeah, good point. That's so fascinating. I had a conversation very similar to this with some students that I'm working with about the question started off as how to start a painting. And sort of the question behind the question is, you know, as artists, should we always start the painting in exactly the same way? Should it be this really controlled thing? What level of experimentation is quote unquote okay? And I gave my answer to that to the student, but I'm curious, given this conversation, how would you answer that if somebody, if another artist came up to you and said, you know, like, I just don't know, like, I'm trying to figure things out. And is there a way that I should start my painting?
I'd say no. I mean, in terms of starting it the same way over and over again, I don't have a very good formula as to how to do anything. I feel like I'm not, I don't know if it's amnesia or something, but I can never actually remember a set way I do things. And so, you know, every time I start painting again, I think this is just feels completely like I have no idea what I'm doing and I'm starting from scratch and I've never done this before pretty much every time that I start something. It's just not starting the same way. I mean, I might try to start the same way technically with materials. So I may say, okay, I'm going to do a watercolor washy background and then I'm going to sketch my composition. And then on top of that, I'm going to then lay in some gestural brush strokes, you know, so that would be okay. That's sort of the same, but I might not actually be working from a drawing, or I might be working from a drawing, or I may choose to do more of a thick brushes and then go in with line, or then I might go in with line first and then erase that. Like, I feel like it always changes depending on what the canvas is. It's never sort of the same as the time before, which I think maybe it has to be that way in order to listen to the canvas, because otherwise it's probably just not going to be the same, you know?
Yeah, that's a very similar to what my response was. I think it's an interesting question, though, because so many artists struggle with trying to find their voice, and they worry so much about that, and they think that it's about repeating a process and looking for a formula, which to me, like, immediately my hackles go up when there's any formula to it. So I think I would say that I'm much more of an intuitive painter. I have almost no plan other than I know the subject matter that I want to paint. And beyond that, there is nothing mapped out and there's nothing repeatable about it. It feels like maybe the a similar thing to a cook who needs to follow a precise recipe and measure things out, as opposed to somebody who cooks like I do, which is open the refrigerator, see what's in there, and start throwing things into the pan.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, for me, it works that way for sure. The only thing I do sometimes do is, and probably because I'm trying to leave a certain, if I'm working on a canvas and I like a lot of it, but I don't like a lot of it, which is probably every canvas I've ever done, then I'll say, you know, I'm going to leave that, but I really want to try this thing that's on this canvas over on this other canvas. And I've started doing because I used to actually probably paint about 100 paintings on one canvas. And now I've learned, okay, just take another canvas and start again.
Was that a big transition for you to get to that stage of your process? Did you just realize like, okay, this canvas is completely overpainted? Or did you just feel like you needed to get that line or get that gesture fresh without anything underneath?
I think I struggled with that my whole life. And I think at some point, and I don't know when exactly, I probably do it sometimes and I don't do it sometimes, that I realized, oh, you know what, let's just try this again somewhere else. One thing that's happened as I've gotten older is I've become hopefully a little bit more mature of how I handle my, you know, emotions regarding every canvas, is to let things go a lot more than I used to be able to, you know, and just go, you know what, actually, that's probably a lot more interesting than had I made that so perfect as, you know, part of that had been. And I think also we just every day we cover up so many things as a painter, you know, you just cover up so many things that you loved. So you have to get used to that, the dying of things, you know, on a daily basis.
That's a great way to put it. It's that idea of killing your darlings, I guess. You know, you can really destroy a painting by falling in love with a corner of it and trying so hard to keep that corner when that corner has sort of taught you a lesson already and you can move on now.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed as life has gone on is that my paintings tend to be what you see is tends to be the last 2 days I've worked on it. And that may be a 3-day painting and it might be a 3-month painting. But even if it's a 3-month painting, it's, you know, I can't really keep anything because it becomes a sort of dance of energy and movement and gesture, and that it all has to sort of work together. So I can't really leave something from 3 weeks ago because it's never going to work with what I'm doing today, you know?
Mm-hmm. I'm actually kind of surprised by that looking at your paintings because they just look so immediate that it's hard for me to imagine that there's anything underneath them.
Yeah. I mean, which is probably why, because they're literally the last 2 days, you know, they are immediate by the time you see them. And I think sometimes I just have to do that figure or that gesture or that anatomy or that foot. I just have to understand it. And it may take me 20 times of repainting that foot. But it is, I think, about just having to come to an understanding of something before you can put it out there.
Right. So if you don't mind, can you walk me through that process that you take? So you mentioned that sometimes you work from photos, sometimes you don't. And before we really started talking, you shared with me that you are using yourself as a model this morning.
Today?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about that.
It's funny. I started reading this book, Circe. Do you know about this book?
No.
It was written by Madeline Miller, and it's about the goddess, nymph, sorceress, Circe. I think the Greeks call her Circe. Every page of this book is about 10 paintings, at least for me. Every description she has in this. And there's, you know, I can see Rubens' paintings and all these mythological creatures and animals and gods and goddesses. And it's a very exciting book. But as I'm reading it, I keep envisioning all these paintings. And so today I just thought, okay, I want to actually paint some of these, but I need the anatomy because I can't see that anatomy. And so I just started posing for myself in front of my iPhone so that I could get these poses and what I want to go with these specific animals and what's going to happen, you know, thanks to this book. Such an inspiration.
So does that mean that you, as you're using yourself, are you able to translate images of yourself into an animal? You kind of hinted at that.
No, these will be people with animals, although they might be transforming into an animal. I mean, one of the lines from this book was something about this woman being turned into a bird. And I love that. So I don't know if I'm going to be turning into a bird or if I'm going to have me and this bird actually doing similar positioning. I haven't decided. I don't really know what it's going to look like yet, but.
Uh-huh. And is that,
I'll keep you posted. Pretty...
I'm, yes, please. I'm learning to be less shy about things like that. I'm like, okay, I'll take you up. It's kind of like you. Oh, really? I can come stay at your house?
Yeah, exactly. Sure.
I would love that. So you have this idea and then you go about gathering reference material, whether that's, I love using the selfie for that. And then what happens next? You go about sketching it or are you putting down washes first?
This year, I started doing something different than what I usually do. What I usually do is I'll do some sketches and then I'll do some sort of drawing. And then from there, I'll use that drawing for my painting instead of going back to the original source material because I'm trying to get away from the photographic elements, you know, and really get to the more expressive thing that I did with the drawing. But this year, I did an art residency in Spain in August at Can Serrat, which was out in Elbruc, which is Barcelona, Spain. It was amazing. It was such a beautiful residency. But there's not a lot of space. And I thought, you know, this is going to be my perfect time to force myself to work small because I do really large paintings and even my sketches are large. And I thought, I just want to try to work smaller and just have this be an experiment where can I make this gesture and this movement happen on a much smaller scale. And I also wanted to minimize it to black and white. So I was working with ink. And I had a little pastel in there, so a little bit of color.
That's an ambitious project, though, compared to how you've pretty much changed almost everything.
Yeah, I did. Well, I wanted to see, what do I do? What does my process really look like? Because when you're in it, you're not really paying attention. But there are things that really work for me and things that don't. And I just wanted to see what that looked like if I just minimized everything. And so it's like, okay, what could work better here? You know, if I don't rely on color at all, and I didn't even really rely on composition because I'm kind of putting my figures in the middle of the page with whatever it is that I'm drawing. And then what does this gesture look like? How much information do I need to put in here? How much can I take out? And so then I was using acrylic actually to erase, like a white acrylic to erase a lot of what I would put in. And then I would try to sort of minimize with the gestures. And I do that a lot with the painting anyway. But going back down to the basics has been really an interesting process for me this year. And I really have gotten, it's been exciting.
What was your biggest takeaway from going full, you know, very rich, buoyant colors to black and white?
I think that because I love color so much and I really enjoy all of that, I think that the new ones, because I wasn't going to get to impress myself with all these beautiful colors, then I had to bring that beauty more into the mark making and into the psychological elements of what I was doing. And I think that really came out with these drawings.
By using black and white, because you had to rely more on the form itself?
Right. I think it was more about the form and also more about the gesture. I mean, color can cover up a lot of things too. You know, it's like you can really get so interested in the color that you're not really paying as much attention to the actual mark making itself.
And what was your lesson from going from large paintings to these much smaller drawings? That's another huge shift.
Yeah, it was a huge shift. I was able to do it finally. It didn't take as long as I thought it was going to, actually. But I really did fall in love with the intimacy of these smaller pieces. And I have continued to make them since I've been back in New York, where I could be painting larger again. And I'm using, so today when I was posing for myself, those are going to end up being these smaller black and white drawings. And then what I'm seeing, I think what's going to happen with them is that many of them together are going to become a large painting, but I don't really see it yet what the paintings are going to look like. So I'm just going to continue doing these drawings until I can sort of envisioning them sort of coming together.
Mm-hmm. Just to give people some context for this, when you say large paintings and small drawings, what does that mean?
The drawings are about 14 by 17 inches, and my paintings have been like 68 inches by 78 inches. I actually have this studio now where I could create something like 15 feet by 10 feet. So part of me just really would love to do that. I'm not doing it at this point.
Why not?
I have some shows coming up I need to do, and it seems daunting that when I have the time and I don't need it to turn out well, I don't know what's going to happen. Or even better yet, if someone said, hey, I'll commission you to do this, then that would be my biggest impetus to do it, you know?
Right.
It's hard to do that and go, okay, what's going to happen with it next?
I know. It's so interesting because there's the idea of it, which is just like, hell yes, let's do this. How exciting. And just like, go for it. Have this gigantic canvas that you need a ladder to get to the top to. And then once you're standing in front of it, you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Hey, Goliath, how you doing?
Exactly. Let's go. There's no room for any other canvas in this whole studio now.
Is there anything that scares you about painting?
Oh my gosh, every day. I feel like every day. Yeah. I mean, it's just failure after failure as far as I'm concerned. And it's just trying to have the confidence to keep going and knowing that it's going to turn out, you know, at some point, something will turn out, you know. I do feel every day that I go into it that who knows? Who knows what's going to happen here, you know?
Right. Have you seen that get better as you've...
No. I really haven't. You know, I mean, I think I trust a little bit more or have a little bit more faith. But, you know, the thing is, the better you get, it's a crutch. So, you know, in a way, it's not very helpful to know I can get through this because a lot of getting through it is to use your talents for drawing or whatever to finish the painting. But maybe a lot of times it needs to not be that. It needs to be allowing that other thing to come in or allowing the mystery of the painting to shine through without making it so, quote, perfect. It's almost like it's not even helpful to have all that.
I can hear thousands of artists right now screaming and crying. It's supposed to get better.
I guess it is, but I don't know.
Honestly, I don't think it is. I think that's the big secret that nobody wants to talk about or you don't want to admit because you don't want to crush somebody's dreams. But what I think actually happens is with every canvas, we learn to ask better questions of ourselves or we reach an understanding and then we're like, oh, really? Is that true? Well, if that's true, what about this? And then we have to solve that next problem. So
I agree. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. So if we're doing our jobs, we are constantly torturing ourselves.
Yeah, I pretty much think that's true. I mean, I do think it's true because, you know, if you're not, then what are you doing? You know, I mean, I think that really is the case. And I think, you know, it is about failing. You know, I think that Beckett quote that is always talked about, I think is one of the best quotes about art, about creating art, you know, the try again, fail better, you know?
Yeah. I'm only on the first or second chapter in it, so it's very, very new, but I'm reading, or actually I'm listening to, I should say, an audiobook right now by this woman named Annie Duke, and she's a professional poker player. Super interesting. Thus far in my 1.5 chapters into this book, my mind's already kind of blown by it because she's talking about the concept of failure and how when you've learned to say, I don't know, that's when all the good stuff happens. So if you think about it in terms of scientific discovery, let's say, and I think this, she doesn't talk at all about art, but to me, everything is about art.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly, it's like, I know you're really talking about art, Annie, you're not talking about poker, but that's fine. What I thought was really interesting was that, you know, and this is something that I've been playing around with, is if you walk in believing that you know the answer already, you're screwed. Allowing our default to be, I don't know, is one of the best things that we can do for ourselves as human beings. And in her case, poker.
Thank goodness that's how I live my life right there.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really interesting because the way that she explained it was just, you know, when you walk in assuming that you already know the answer, you stop asking questions.
Yeah, I think that's true.
You miss all of the subtle cues and all of the unknowns. Like there's, you know, these false positives, for example. So that whole concept of redefining the meaning of I don't know from you are wrong, you're a failure, like there's something wrong with you if you don't know the answer, to I don't know being the beginning of an incredible exploration.
Yeah, and I think, at least for me, and paintings I see and paintings I make, when the painting has all the answers, it's not a very interesting painting.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely the better paintings in my mind are ones that are, they're leaving a lot of questions out there.
What are some of the questions that you're playing with right now?
I don't know if I can come up with them in terms of words, but I would say one of the ones with these drawings is, how much can I show with as little amount of lines as I can? How can I show the psychology of the thing without illustrating it? In reading this book, you know, about this nymph, whenever I read about mythology or look at these paintings that have mythology in them, there's so many of these images are, they harken back to, you know, you feel them and you're like, oh yeah, this is us. This is us. I don't know if it's as a culture, this is us as human beings, this is us as animals. But there's stories there, but we don't even know the stories. I mean, I don't remember a lot of these stories. I'm sure I've read about them in history and all that, but there's something to them that's so universal and our subconscious, and being able to paint that, I feel like is painting something about our history, like in our DNA, but I don't know what it is that that is that. But whenever I see anything like it or hear anything like it, there's an aha to it of, oh yeah, this is us. This is, you know, either in our DNA or this is our history, or, you know, it's like cave art or something where you don't understand what it is, but you know it to be true, you know, and it's like the mythology, it's mythology. It's not, I don't know that those things actually happened, but there's a truth in them and a magic to that. And that is what I would like to do. That's what I set out to do when I paint something, is I would like to paint that sort of gray area of not a story. I don't want to do a narrative painting, but I want it to have a truth in it. And a lot of those mythological stories, people do turn into animals, or animals have a huge part in who we are. I think it was Nietzsche, I think, said something about, I should look this up again, but he talked something about our animal selves and the dream life of animals and the truth of the dream life of animals. And I think that's what I think about as well when I see those images or I read about those stories.
Oh, wow. That would be so fascinating.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, just watching a dog sleep and like start to, you know, I'm like, what are you thinking? What is going on in that head of yours?
But if you think about it as our dream life of us as animals, not this higher brain that we have, but the animal part of who we are, what part of that is in our dreams?
Do you remember your dreams?
I remember a lot of my dreams, and I've had a lot of dreams involving animals, which is interesting. I once dreamt that I was getting eaten by a lion, and it was amazing because in the dream, I wasn't afraid, but I could feel the heat and the strength of his jaw. But I thought, okay, this is how I'm going to go. This is okay.
That's great. Did you feel pain?
I did not yet, because he hadn't done it yet, but I knew it was coming, you know. It felt like home in a way. It felt somehow not a bad thing.
Right, right. That's so fascinating. Is it safe to assume that you're familiar with or a fan of Joseph Campbell?
I love Joseph Campbell, yeah. I haven't read any of his stuff in a while. It's been a while since I've read his stuff, but I was thinking about it when you mentioned going into something without knowing the answers, because I thought of his hero's journey and the idiot, you know, like starting off as the idiot.
The other way of saying that is, it was Matisse, right, that said, I know a number of artists have said it, but for some reason I seem to attribute it to Matisse, that the highest ability of an artist is to kind of go back to drawing with the innocence of a child. and that childlike wonder, whether or not it's that skill level, but just that unconscious, I always interpret it as the unconscious. By that, I mean, like, we weren't self-conscious at all about what we drew. It never occurred to us to ask somebody, what do you think? It was more just, I drew this. Look at how awesome it is.
Yeah, I agree. That's so great, that time in your life, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then...
yeah. Well, it's like going back into the sandbox, you know? That idea of just playing and drawing sand pictures and, you know, not on archival paper.
Yeah. And not even considering that. Who cares?
Exactly.
Do you ever get stuck in your work and just kind of blocked? And if so, what do you do?
Absolutely, I get blocked. I think when I get blocked, it tends to be from trying to be a perfectionist about something or another. And I do a couple of different things. One of the things I started doing, which I think is a great thing, which is a Hemingway thing, actually, which I'm sure you've probably heard about, where I think he would leave in the midst of a paragraph or in the midst of an idea and leave his work so that the next day he'll be able to go back to it and know exactly where he left off. So it's not so difficult to get back into it. That is one thing I've started doing. And in fact, with these drawings, some of it's working, some of it's not. I'll just erase everything that's not and then just wait till the next day until I have a fresher way of looking at it. And generally it'll go and I'll finish it in 2 seconds the next day because I've just for that, you know, because I think a lot of that blockage is where you're trying to perfect something, and then just becomes this really boring thing that you've created, you know? So I think a lot of the times getting rid of it and going, okay, I have that information and I'll use that the next time, but I'll do it in a much more spontaneous and interesting way, hopefully.
Do you look at other artists for inspiration?
Oh, yeah. I love going to the Met, as I said before, like Baroque and Rococo art. I'll just go in there and look at what they've done and look at their subject matter and look at their movement and their gestures and all of that. And then I also love looking at contemporary artists and seeing what people are doing. I love looking on Instagram, like just seeing what people are doing. Oh, look at that artist. Like, that person's really going out on a limb with this new body of work or whatever. And I think that's really inspiring to see other people being courageous, you know, about how they're making strides in their work. And sometimes it's also failures that people do. And that can be inspiring too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. To see somebody go out on a limb and
it didn't work, but who cares? You know, they tried something and they'll try something else.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so fun to see. Yeah. I actually love that.
I do too. And it feels good. I mean, it's funny. When I was in Spain, there was a Picasso museum. There's a Picasso museum in Barcelona because he grew up there. And it has some of the worst Picasso paintings I've ever seen in my life. I didn't even know he did so many bad paintings. And I just loved it. It just was so inspiring to me because you always think of him as just this genius who being just so confident all the time that, you know, even if it was a bad painting, there's something kind of interesting about the confidence that he instilled in it. But these earlier works when he was a kid that didn't have that confidence. So it's like, it's much more sort of boring kind of work. And it was great to see.
Like some of his early, early stuff where he has no personality.
No, none. It was fascinating, wasn't it?
Yeah, I love it because those paintings to me are almost a warning to other artists.
Yeah.
To go out on the limb and, you know, like, can you imagine if he didn't go out on a limb and his paintings were pretty much, you know, just those, but quote unquote, better executed, how awful that would be for us.
Absolutely.
It's empowering. I love it. This is the question I love asking people for so many reasons. If you could own a painting by any living artist, what would it be or whose?
There's so many. So many. I mean, it would probably be the artist has to be living.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll tell you why later, but yeah.
Okay. Because I'll get one. Okay.
I wish I could be like Oprah and you get a painting and you get a painting.
I love the German paint. I have a lot of German in me and I really relate to those German painters. And I would probably pick a few. So Gerhard Richter, there's a lot of his paintings. I particularly love the paintings he did, which were not very popular, but he did these paintings that were based on old masters that he, I think he must have done an actual, one of them was like the Annunciation of, I forget what those are. But anyway, he did those and then he took a big brushstroke to it and made these gorgeous, gorgeous, beautiful paintings. And they're not like amazing Richter paintings, but they're these beautiful little gorgeous paintings. I would want one of those. And Marlene Dumas is one of my favorites because I think she's, there's so much magic and strength in her paintings and they're so, boy, she doesn't overwork them. It doesn't look like ever. And Julie Mayrout too. I love her, particularly her newer huge paintings, but they have great movement to them and they're really loose compared to what her older work.
Mm. The reason that I asked that question is because if I say any artist, it typically elicits very similar responses from people. But if it's living, then we get to both promote and learn about living artists. So that's kind of why I constrain it like that. And then secretly, sometimes I pull guests from that. I'm like, oh, I don't know that person. I'd like to meet them.
Right.
So that's why I asked that evil question.
Yeah. I could name probably 20 others, but those come to mind as I see some of those paintings and I think, oh, God, I'd love to have that.
Mm. One of my students actually did that to me. I was like, okay, you guys, if you have any questions, you can ask me. And she turned the tables on me and asked my own evil question. I was like, that's not fair.
Who did you pick?
Well, Anne Gale for sure is somebody that I can't get enough of her work. Like I'll just stick my nose to it and stare at it every chance I get. I just really, really love her work. And it's such a difficult question because it's like, it really kind of forces you to kind of go back through your head and like really think about like, okay, that piece and that piece.
Yeah.
There's not enough wall space in the world for all of the paintings I want, I think. Like, I really love the work that's not finished, that guttural, instinctive work I really respond to. I appreciate the, you know, people who like the really finished work, but I'm usually way more fascinated by seeing their sketchbooks or...
Oh, me too.
The unfinished pieces or the ones that they think aren't that great.
Yeah. One of the things I'm excited about with drawing, because, you know, you get to see all the little things that make up that piece, you know, and those are so exciting. But Marlene Dumas, that was another reason I really love her because her paintings look like drawings to me and they always look unfinished. They never look finished to me, which I think is so exciting. Like that she's had the courage to leave them that way, you know?
Yeah. I don't know her work, so now I'm definitely going to look it up because now that you've said that, I'm like...
You'll love it. You will love her work. She's South African, and I think she lives in Amsterdam. I think she's the one who started, I could be wrong about this, but I think she started her artist statement as, I'm a dirty painter, and I love that.
I like her already.
Yeah. And her work, it has that in the gutter kind of thing about it, which... you know, heightens the excitement of the work.
I am definitely looking her up now.
I think I read that she's also one of the highest paid female living artists. And so I love that about her too. I love that she somehow got herself in there with paintings that aren't, you wouldn't necessarily think that would be the case. So
that's so empowering. I love it when, somebody... You know, of course, especially women, because women tend to be so underrepresented in the art world. So I do, obviously, I am biased in that sense that I will get more excited about that. But I will freely admit that. This is my podcast. I can say it. I'll admit my bias.
Well, I just thought I'd add that in there. I mean, I love her work regardless. She made no money at it, but it makes me very happy that she does make money at it.
Yeah, I mean, I applaud anyone who does it and who can. I mean, it's tough. It's really hard. So the fact that you can succeed like that is just such a testament to your work and your perseverance and et cetera, et cetera. But I think like women have way more hurdles. So anytime when I hear that, I'm just like, hell yes, go girl.
Yeah, me too.
I get overly excited by it.
Me too.
Awesome. Well, Suzanne, where can people see your work?
Well, right now, right now I have I'm on a show that's up in Tribeca at a gallery called One Art Space. And I'll be doing a show in a couple of weeks that's opening at PS122 Gallery, which is a gallery, is they're going to be in their inaugural show. And it's at a space that I had, actually my painting space is in that building now, my painting studio, but it was an art studio program I did years ago, was through this art organization. And I just love them. It was the luckiest, the biggest gift. I got this huge studio from them with these huge high ceilings and big windows, which in New York City is just amazing. You know, it was on a roof with a 2000 square foot roof that I could go out on, you know. It was amazing. They're opening a gallery. They used to have a gallery as well, but they just opened up their new space and they're going to do an exhibit of work from past studio program recipients. That's going to open on January 19th, PS122 Gallery. And then I'm doing a project space sometime this winter at the Sarah Nightingale Gallery in Sag Harbor. So that's coming up.
Is that winter? Well, I was going to say winter 29. Is that the current winter or winter?
That's going to be, I think it's going to be this winter or the spring. She hasn't come up with the dates yet. So we haven't figured that out. They're going to be drawings, which I'm what I'm working on now, but I need to do more of them. So we're not going to have a date until I finish those, but you know.
So is that like the 2019-2020 winter or the current one?
It's supposed to be the current one.
Okay, 2018-2019.
I'll keep you posted. Yes. It's going to happen, though. It's going to happen.
Okay. And then obviously also it's Suzanne Runyon. Onion.
Suzanne Online. Suzanne
God,
Online.
I just like, I'm...
You said it right the first time.
I think I have like a verbal dyslexia or something where I'll just like, boom, it goes out exactly the opposite. Yeah, SuzanneUnrein.com. That was funny.
People say that all the time. People always say that wrong.
If I don't look at the word and I'm just talking, then that's fine. Or if I'm mentally one step ahead, then I'll just flip things like crazy. And I'm just like, okay, back, slow down.
You know, this is an interesting side note, because I love that my last name is German. And it is actually pronounced in German, Unrein. And it actually means impure, unclean, which I think is such a great name for a painter, don't you?
I love that.
Yeah, me too. I love it.
So do you pronounce it here Unrein or Unrein?
I do Unrein.
You do Unrein. I'm going to start calling you. I'm just going to say this is Suzanne Unrein.
You can.
Don't freak everybody out. You're saying her name wrong.
Feel free. Circe, the book that I'm reading, you know, the Greeks call it Kirke, but to me, it's so hard because I remember when you study the classics, like I've never heard her name said that way. You know, so it's always weird when you actually hear it from the language that it came in because you're not used to it, you know?
Yes, for sure. There's many words like that I have like that I'm just like, I can't wrap my head around that.
Well, when I was in Barcelona, I just could not do the whole lisp thing of Barcelona. You know, just bugged. I couldn't do it. I have to say Barcelona.
Barcelona.
Yeah. Just felt like I had a lisp every time I said it.
Do you speak Spanish?
I don't, but I did pretty well while I was there. I mean, they could actually understand me, you know, very little. I was doing very little of it, but just the basics, getting around. I got better and better at it. I lived in Mexico here and there for a few years. And so my Spanish got pretty good while I was there, but I pretty much forget everything if I don't need it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. My husband always gives me a very hard time about that. I'm like, look, you know what? I'm really good at some things and there's only so much room in my brain because there's so much information in there.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, we're supposed to be able to remember a lot more things, but I don't know. It doesn't work for me too much.
No, and I see no reason to remember actors' names. I'm not an actor. I don't care.
Yeah, any of that. I'm with you.
Yeah, sorry.
And I read all the time, but I often don't remember the author's names, which I feel really bad about, actually, because I do feel like I should remember their names. But I do remember the book name and I remember the plot, usually.
Yeah, well, that was what I was experiencing with the degenerate art. I was like, I have that book. I have gone through it a million times. I can tell you exactly what the cover looks like, but I cannot tell you the name of the book. Yeah.
Well, I remember it because that was so fascinating to me that all these artists were considered degenerate artists. You know, I mean, just love that. Because, of course, now, you know, it's just a whole different ballgame for them. You know, and, of course, the artists that were so popular back then, are just we don't even remember them, nor were they particularly interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Well, Suzanne, thank you so much. This was fabulous.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast with the artist Suzanne Unrein. Thank you so much to Suzanne for sharing her story and also to Marie Thibault for connecting us. Go to savvypainter.com and click on the podcast tab. You'll find show notes there, examples of Suzanne's work, and links to connect with her. The Savvy Painter Podcast is made possible in large part by artists just like you. If you would like to help out, it's quick, it's easy, and I cannot tell you how much I appreciate it. Just go to savvypainter.com/support. If this podcast has made a difference in your studio, if it gives you a little bit of company while you are painting, please consider making a donation. Any amount helps. And with that, I would like to give a shout out and a big, big thank you to Renat Gorin, Psychodynamic Yoga, Lois McCarthy, Robert Doucette, Denise Presnell, Cherie Seinkowitz. Cherie, I really hope I said your last name right. Vivian Larkins, Diane Foster, Julie Riley, Leanne Harrison, Nicola Pixworth, Diane McGee, Robert Talbert, Judith Chapman, Susan Rose, Helen O'Connor, Julie Marr, J.A. Moore, Marilyn Creary, Teresa Hill, Vincent Keeling, Brian Buckrell, Alchemy Works, Denise Klitzy, Deb Cook Shapiro, Gleary Fine Art, Lucinda Kasser, Pat Oxley, Jill Opelka, Susan Zefting Kuhn, Kathleen Speranza, ZB Gallery, and David Gorski. Thank you so, so much for your support of The Savvy Painter. So until the next time, this is Antrese Wood with The Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.